I'm an alcoholic. My name is Rick Lang.
By the grace of God and by following the suggested program of recovery as outlined in How It Works, I have been sober since the 5th of 1991. And that is indeed a miracle, and if you need references, I can provide them. I got to start this with a story that my mother told, and I got to give you some background before it makes sense. I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and the population of my hometown the year after I was born was 1,748 people. There's more people in town like than my hometown. Probably still is. It's still a small town. I've got two older sisters, a twin sister who was 5 minutes older than I am, and I never let her forget it. A younger brother and a younger sister, so there was a bunch of us. But my dad was a mechanic for the U.S. Army Air Force in World War II, and he was stationed in India. And when they got to India, they had so many mechanics, they made him a cook. So one of the other things that Raleigh didn't talk about was the fact that I do love to cook, because I have this problem with eating. I love to eat, too. So I cook for myself, and I weigh way too much. But anyway, we'll go on. On big celebrations in my family, my dad would invite all of the relation over and a significant number of neighbors. And I guess I never really had a chance in here because my dad worked in a brewery. He worked for at first Blatt's, and then he wound up at Pabst. So beer was always in the house. But on our first birthday, my twin sister and I, they invited the family over, and we were born in July. So they were having an outside picnic, and one of the things that was always present at one of these functions was a big tub of ice just stuffed with beer cans. In this case, in the summertime, they had the bottles. So my mother says, now again, this is my mother's story, not mine. My mother says that what they would do is they would take me outside and put me on the ground, and I would crawl from beer bottle to beer bottle. And everybody thought it was so cute that they just picked me up and give me a slug. She says she poured me into bed that night. Now, I can neither confirm nor deny that story because I was one, but it sounds like something I would have done. And that's kind of the description of what I tried for a long time. Drinking didn't really get significant for me until I was close to my 18th birthday. In the state of Wisconsin, the legal drinking age for everything was 21 years old. But they also had a provision in their law that each county could decide whether they wanted to establish what were known as minor bars, where you were allowed to drink beer at the age of 18. And the county I grew up in was one of those who chose to do so. So on our 18th birthday, there were two significant things that I had to do. One was to go register for the Selective Service, the draft. There was this little conflict going on in Southeast Asia, and they were wetting bodies. So I had to go and tell them I was 18, da-da-da-da-da. And one of the things they always asked you to do was to explain significant scars so that they had identifying marks in case you were killed. Well, I had forgotten about this one on my chin. And when I went back to pick up my state ID to go to the minor bars, I went back to the draft Selective Service office and I told them about it. And the lady looked at me with just a deadpan on her face and said, "Don't worry about it. They'll never notice that scar because your head's going to get blown off anyway." Welcome to the world. About 3 months after my 18th birthday, I started college at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Playboy magazine, every year Playboy would rank the party schools across the United States. The year I started, in September, one of our cheerleaders was actually on the cover of the magazine. No pictorial, but she was on the cover. They had the list of the top 25 party schools, and they had an asterisk right at the title. The University of Wisconsin was conspicuously absent. But if you go down to the asterisk, it said, "We did not include the University of Wisconsin in this survey because we felt it was unfair to compare professionals with amateurs." I was in the right place. I got through school pretty easy until college. I liked math, liked science, hated English. Typical man. And I got into college and I skated through high school because I was able to remember stuff and regurgitate it when I needed to. They asked a lot more of you in college, and I didn't want to do the work. So I struggled. Calculus was a foreign language to me, but I had to take it because in engineering school, you have to have calculus. So I struggled with that. I spent a lot of time in college on social probation because my grade point average was so low, but they kept letting me back in. I flunked out twice. The first time was a formality. It just said, hey, I want to go back. They said, okay. Second time, they asked me if I was really serious about this. And I told the guy I was because I knew what the result would be if I didn't. I get a free trip to Southeast Asia for 12 months. Didn't sound like a good deal to me. So it was at that point, really, that I hooked up with a guy that I had been on a dorm floor with my freshman year. And the two of us started studying together. His kid was really smart. And I learned a lot from him about how to study and what to learn. And I managed to actually get a high enough grade point average to graduate. In fact, last semester I was there, I made Dean's List, which is mind-boggling. But when you think about it, I had 16 class hours. I had 8 of them pass-fail because there were so many riots going on that school got disrupted all the time. I had 8 of them pass-fail, and I only had 3 engineering courses, and one of them was an easy A, so I got the Dean's List. I got the certificate and everything somewhere. My first job was in Chicago, and my mother was born in Chicago. She had lived most of her life there until she married my dad and moved up to Wisconsin. I had a bunch of aunt and uncles that were still in the area, so I just kind of felt at home. But the drinking wasn't terrible, but on those days that I drank, it was over the top. And it went on like that for a while. The job I had, I lasted there for a little over 4 years, and this big chemical company came knocking on my door asking me to take a 30% wage increase and a huge amount of expense benefits. And I'm going, okay, I can do that. So they shipped me to Detroit. 2 years later, they shipped me from Detroit to Boston. 2 years after that, they shipped me from Boston to Atlanta. And in every one of those areas, I would have periods of not insane alcoholism, but I wouldn't have really sobriety because I didn't know what sobriety was. I didn't drink a lot, but when I drank way too much. Came down here, spent first 4 years. In 85, I transferred divisions within Allied. And that's when things started to get really crazy. This was a division that we made a lot of money, and they let us spend it. Now, when I went to Michigan, they gave me an expense account of $25,000 a year. And I could not for the life of me, just to tell you how naive I was, I could not in the life figure out how in the world you could spend that much money in 1 year. I found out you can. But starting with the transfer over to the solvent group, I got hooked up with a bunch of guys who liked to drink. They were big guys, they drank hard, and I drank right with them. Now, I couldn't drink as much as they did, but that didn't stop me. And there were a lot of mornings when just getting out of bed was a real struggle, but we had a hell of a lot of fun. We did a hell of a lot of good, and we made a lot of money for the company. But I got into some trouble in the late 80s, and the big thing was in late 1990, I supposedly went to a company function that was through one of our distributors. I got absolutely hammered and wrecked a car. I mean, it was awful. I hit this parked car, and I had no idea what was on. I was in a blackout until the incident happened. I was looking at the car, and I couldn't figure out where all that noise had come from. And I looked over to my right side, and something was wrong, and I knew it, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was until I realized the rearview mirror on the outside of the car was now on the inside. The window was gone. This car was a wreck. So I, being the smart person that I was, I drove away. Well, it turns out I also had a flat tire. And it was one of these cars with the fancy wheels. I couldn't get that tire off. So I just took everything out of the car that identified me, called a cab, went back to my hotel. Now, the next morning, it dawns on me that I got to let people know what happened to this car. And I'm coming up with a story, and I'm coming up with another story. And none of them are being blocked. So I get this little notice that the Florida State Patrol wants to talk to me. And I'm going, oh, this is good. They come into my room, and they're talking, and they wind up giving me 2 tickets. If they had given me a breath test, I probably would have failed it at that time. But they didn't. So they gave me 2 tickets, and then they told me to appear in court about a month later. Well, in addition to that, I had to fill out an accident report for the company. And I guess I must have been looking for something in the way of a change, because I tried to come up with a story that I thought they would believe as to how this car got wrecked, without telling them that I was in a blackout and drunk on my ass. And at the very end, after writing this thing, which I didn't even believe after I wrote it, I just made this little announcement, and I put down in 3 words, had been drinking. And I sent it off. And shortly after I had my court appearance, I flew down to Fort Lauderdale, and the court was in Pompano Beach. Took a cab, sat there, and the judge starts asking me some questions, and he asked me, well, what were you thinking? And I just looked at him and said, I have absolutely no idea. So the judge says, okay, well, we're going to fine you. And I'm going, whew, that's a break. We're going to give you $50 fine on the one charge and $35 on the other. And I'm going, and I got $1,000 in cash in my pocket, and that's all you're going to do to me? Then I got upset because the person there didn't know how to make change for a $100 bill on an $85 debt. Then I got further upset after lunch because now I had to call a cab and spend some more money, where if I'd gotten a car, I would have been able to just take off. I was thinking very clearly, very clearly. We have a sales meeting a couple of weeks after that, and both of the top managers of the group asked me what had happened, and I told them. But I was very nonchalant about it. They said, well, what if they had suspended your license? I said, well, I would just have him drive me around. I guess that must have set him off, because the next morning he told me, you need to do something to show us that you're going to try to get sober. And I'm looking at him going, you're forcing me to get sober? What about these guys I drink with? What about them? They didn't care about them. They didn't have a wreck. So now I'm in full victim mode. So I do some checking around, and I know a lot of you know Harry O. His dad ran a counseling session in Smyrna, a group called SIOPA. It's another one of these acronyms. And it's for sobriety is our greatest asset. I heard that, and I'm going, really? Sobriety? Oh, well. So I went there, and the first thing they did was give me one of these tests. And, of course, if you're at all intelligent, you can figure out what they're trying to accomplish. So I answered what I thought would get me released. Well, they had one question in there, have you ever drank in the morning? And I wrote, no. One of the assistants who was working there looked at me and says, have you ever had a drink after midnight? I said, well, sure. He said, can you drink in the morning? I'm going, oh, come on. Come on. So I signed up for it, and I go to my first session. It's on a date. Gave me the wonderful chance of doing 2 hours on Thursday night and then an hour on Saturday so I could get my hours in a reasonable amount of time. So I go to the first session, and from this point on, weird situations keep happening to me. They broke us up into groups, and we were doing a little contest, and I had this woman walk up to me, and she looked at me, and she said, hello, and can I help you? And I thought she was snooty as hell. I found out later she thought I was an arrogant ass. 20 years, 27 years later, she's still right. But I got even with her. I married her 5.5 years later. And then after that session was over, Obi was presented a cake for his 17-year birthday. And I'm not sure I had that time. I had 17 hours, much less 17 days. So I went up to him after the meeting, and I asked him, how does it feel to be sober for 17 years? And he looked at me and he says, when you get 17 years, you come and tell me. I'm going, you son of a bitch. How arrogant are you? Good news is I got to tell him. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I have a diagnosed hearing problem. I have what is known as asymmetric hearing. I hear better from my right side than I do from my left side. My real problem is I have selective hearing. If you're familiar with the song The Boxer by Simon and Garfunkel, there's a line in there that goes, all I suggest is a man still hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. That was me. If you're familiar at all with Appendix 2 about the spiritual experience, at the very end of it, there's this philosopher who goes on, and he basically says at the end of it, what will keep me in eternal darkness is contempt prior to investigation. And that was me. That identified me. Should have had my name right next to it, but that was me. I didn't want this. I didn't need it. I had no desire to be there, but I had to go through the motions. So I would go to my sessions on Thursday night. As soon as I got home, I would get drunk. And I'd stay drunk most of Friday. I'd try to sober up enough so my Saturday session, I was somewhat coherent. And then I'd stay drunk the rest of the weekend. And I thought that was perfectly normal. And I did some really interesting stuff. Like, as soon as one of the things they told me was, you should get all the booze out of your house. So I took all the bottles, put them in a box, took them down to my storage unit, and then I'd go to the liquor store and buy more. I thought that was normal. It was one Saturday morning when I was really feeling bad, and I knew I had to have a drink before I went there because I was shaking and everything else, and I'm waiting for 10 o'clock to come, and I'm waiting for 10 o'clock to come. I get to the liquor store and open at 9. It's a good thing I didn't get there at 9 because I'd have been drunk by 11. But I didn't really, I heard the words, they just didn't mean anything to me because I had no interest in being sober. And I kept hearing them talk about sobriety. And I had no idea what sobriety was. To me, it was sober. And I started questioning, do I want to be sober? Because what about all these sober judges that we have who are getting busted for all this stuff? Do I want to be one of them? And no, I didn't want to get busted, is what it really came down to. The only reason I was going through this was because I had to do it to save my job. So I just kept on drinking, and I'd go to my sessions, and it didn't mean anything to me. Well, in coming up into 91, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we were in the process of introducing a new product. I was dealing with a customer. I was in NASCAR country. And I was dealing with a customer who had a different solvent that they were using. I was trying to get him to use ours, so we'd put a bunch of solvent in there and we'd test it for a few weeks. And I'd go to his plant in the morning. The first thing I'd do is find where the bathroom was. Because if I was going to get sick, I wanted to make sure it wasn't by the machine. I wanted to make it to the bathroom. And I thought that was normal. I'd stay at the plant for a couple of hours, where there really wasn't all that much I could do. I'd leave, I'd pick up a bottle on the way home, and I'd get drunk. And I'd do this day in, day out. Well, for some reason, it was on a Wednesday, and I had gotten drunk after my visit to the plant, and I knew that it dawned on me that if I kept doing what I was doing at the rate I was doing it, I was going to die. And I didn't want to die. I knew that living wasn't all that great, but I thought dying was a tad too permanent. So I had to do something different. And I'd heard multiple times that if you ask for help from God, you will get it. So I got on my knees and I asked God to let me sleep through the night. Because I was sleeping about 3 hours. Then I'd have to wake up, drink for a couple hours, and then go back to pass out. And I slept through the night, which is the first time it happened in months. So I got home. The last bottle that I had, it was a bottle of Famous Grouse Scotch. Good stuff, too. Threw it in the trash heap, and I went to my session that night. And I walk in the door, and one of the counselors is sitting at his desk. He looks up, and he says, hi, Rick, how you doing? And I'm looking at him, and I can't remember his name. I cannot remember his name to save my soul. And I'm standing there staring, and he looks at it, and he says, temporary insanity? And I said, nope, I think it's permanent. That's the day I had my last drink. That was the first day that I did not have a drink in I don't know how long. But now I still got a problem because I'm not really getting anything out of the sessions I'm going to. And I had heard them talking about AA over and over and over. So after the session on that Friday, I went to my first AA meeting on Friday night. And I was living in Marriott at the time. And there's a place called Rebo's down in Smyrna. To show you how smart I was, it took me a year and a half to figure out that Rebo's was sober spelled backwards. Couldn't figure it out. So I go there, and I knew the meeting started at 8 o'clock, and I couldn't find this place. I knew exactly where it was, and I couldn't find it. I'm driving around. I finally get into the meeting. I get a cup of coffee, sit down at the back of the room, I look around the room, and the clarity that came through at that moment was unbelievable with my attitude. I looked around the room and said, God, I'm overdressed. That's the only thing I was thinking about. I had a polo shirt on, a pair of slacks, and I was overdressed. I mean, the way I went in was... So anyway, at the end of the meeting, they said, if you don't have a sponsor, please go over to this booth area and we'll get you one. So they introduced me to my first sponsor, who was Bill W. Not that Bill W., but Bill W. He had 27 years. He gave me his business card. He worked over at Lockheed. He says, call me every day. And he says, you will go to the same meetings that I go to. And tomorrow night, you will be here for the speaker meeting at 8:30. And I said, okay. But being the intelligent person that I am, I figured out, well, if he's working, I'll just call his house, and he won't be there. He called me back. I sure didn't expect that. So I went to the speaker meeting, and again, I go in with this really clear mind. I'm sitting down over where my sponsor was, and I'm looking around the room, and I see a guy sitting at a chair. He's got a suit on. I point to him and say, that guy's really overdressed. I look at him again. He says, boy, he looks awful familiar. I looked at him the third time. It was my neighbor. We were living in the same condo building. He was 9 years sober. I had been to ball games with him. I played golf with him. I'd never seen him take a drink. But he never said anything but to me about not drinking. Because I never got drunk with him. But little by little, I was going to meetings, I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't happy. Now, the first 30 days, just the fact that I was physically getting better was great. After about 32 days, it was like, okay, what's next? Because that had always been my plan or my program. Get something new, and it holds your attention for a while, and when it gets old, you get something new to replace it. It didn't make any difference what the new was, what the item was. It just, you had to be something new. And nothing was new. I just kept going to meetings, and I wasn't drinking, which was new. But the novelty had worn off. So I just kept going, and I was struggling. It just didn't make any sense. Then October came. And in October, I had the week. I had been in St. Louis. We're visiting some customers or calling on some potential customers, and I'd gotten a call where one of the regional sales manager wanted to meet with me on Monday morning at a hotel near the airport in Atlanta. So I go down to meet him at 8 in the morning. And you could drive in Atlanta at that time and still have to fight the traffic we have today. This is quite a while ago. What I found out was I was being let go. They were reducing in force, and I was being riffed. And I knew more about it than he did. Later on that day, the girl that I had been seeing, who was part of a work for a division that I used to work for, but had been spun off into another company, called me, and I just ripped her. I was pissed at something. I don't know what. So Tuesday, she called me and said, "Goodbye. I don't need this shit from you." Smart move on her part. Then I got a little notice on Wednesday saying that I needed to go up to the State Patrol office on the North 120 loop for a meeting on Thursday. I'm going, I wonder what this is about. So I go there and find out that the state of Florida has notified the state of Georgia that I have pled no contest to these things, and combined with a no contest plea I had made a few years earlier, they were going to suspend my license. I hadn't done anything in Georgia. How can they suspend my license? So the state patrol officer says, we're going to take your license for 120 days. And I said, well, okay, I'm unemployed. How do I get to, you know, to interviews and all this? Well, they'll make arrangements for you to get a temporary license, restricted license. Now, I had driven over there. And I drove back home. I go to the motor vehicle department the next day, and I drive down to the motor vehicle department around Marietta. And I park my car about a half a block away at another office complex so they wouldn't see me driving up. And I go in there, and I tell them why I'm there, and they take my license. And I said, well, what about my restricted license? And I said, State Patrol, I had no right telling you you were going to get one because we're not going to give you one. And I said, well, how am I supposed to get to, you know, like the store for food and go to any? Just, you should have thought about that before you drank. He didn't make a friend that day. So, being the calm, collected person that I am, I walked over to my car and drove home. I'm driving with no license, and I got 120 days. And I just kept on doing it because it was normal to me. Now, I'm supposed to be sober, but all that meant was I hadn't had a drink in a while. The way my sponsor described it in his inimitable way with words was, I was as dry as a popcorn fart about his value. That hurt my pride. But I kept doing this for a number of months. And I knew that if I drove at off-peak hours and I drove the speed limit and everything, the odds of my getting stopped were pretty small. Well, in February, one of the guys I used to work with had switched over to a different division. He called me up and said he was going to be in Atlanta. And I said, well, let's go play golf. He says, okay, I don't have much to do that day. I can do that. So I had some privileges at a country club up in Norcross. So we drove up to Norcross. Well, in February, even down here, we do get frost from time to time. And it was one of those days when we had frost on the greens, and you can't play golf when you have frost on the greens until they thaw, because you do too much damage to the grass. So they just kept moving all the tee times back, and they kept moving all the tee times back. Well, my buddy looks at it, he says, it's getting late. He says, I got to get to the airport to get home. I said, okay. So we canceled our tee time. He took off for the airport, and I took off for home. And I would usually get off at the perimeter at Powers Ferry Road and then take the back roads to where I lived in Marietta. Well, I'm on Terrell Mill Road. I turn right onto Bentley Road. I get 90% of the way to my front driveway, and right in the middle of the road is a traffic stop. And they are checking driver's license and registration. And I have neither. And just as I get up there, with the blinker on, to turn, the guy waved me through. And to this day, I have no idea why they let me through, but they did. That was the impetus that kind of broke this idea that I could do whatever I wanted with impunity. And I started hearing, and I heard this, I don't know how many times, but I started hearing about looking at your shortcomings and looking at your inventory. So for some reason, I started writing. And I started writing. And I had lots of time because I was unemployed. It's easy to write 4 stuff when you're not doing anything else. I'd write for a while, leave, come back the next day, write some more. And what amazes me when I look back on it today is how the information, how these resentments and how this anger, as I looked at the newer stuff, the older stuff became visible. And when I looked at that, the stuff that was older than that became visible. And it was almost like it was flowing onto the paper because I was ready to do it. And I went through this whole thing, and I talked to my sponsor one day, and I said, I would like to get together with you and do a 5th step. Well, he looked at me, and he says, have you done a 3rd step? I'm going, I think so. He says, well, we'll talk about it when you get here. So I go over to his apartment. And the first thing he does is open up the book to the 5th chapter. I think it's on page 62. And he says, we're going to do a 3rd step prayer. He says, get down on your knees, we'll hold hands. And I'm going, what did I just get myself into? men don't hold hands. Not 92. So we said a third step prayer, and one of the things that I'd always struggled with the entire time I'd been in AA prior to that was if I really was bad enough as an alcoholic to belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember the AA commercial where you saw the guy passed out in a club car on a train with his drink tipped off to the side, almost spilling the whole thing, and my first comment was, I've never done that. I knew just enough about Alcoholics Anonymous before I came here to know that Alcoholics Anonymous went to meetings. And I knew I couldn't be an alcoholic because I didn't go to meetings. So there was another justification. But while we were doing my fifth step with my sponsor, we'd go through some things, and he'd ask me if I had done this bad thing or that bad thing, and I'm thinking to myself, no, was I supposed to? Again, I was trying to meet a definition of alcoholism I didn't understand. And I was only starting to get a grasp of what life could be without alcohol with a higher power. And then I heard the one thing that I needed to hear in a meeting, and it came from a person I didn't have a whole lot of respect for. And the guy said, I don't have to be as alcoholic as anybody in this room. I just have to be alcoholic enough for myself. And that broke down a lot of the barriers. I didn't have to qualify. I probably had. I just didn't think I was bad enough. I couldn't come up with the idea of taking my windshield washer reservoir out, sterilizing it, filling it with alcohol, running the tube into the car, and when I wanted to drink, just hit the windshield washer button. Or taking raisins and soaking them in 151 rum and taking them to work as a snack. And I should have been able to figure this stuff out. I'm an engineer. I've got the degree to prove it. And I couldn't think of this. So I was constantly trying to compare what I hadn't done with what other people had done. I struggled with it for a long time. But when I got that free pass, so to speak, that started to make some sense. I began to understand that sobriety is more than just not drinking. There's just a whole lot more to it. But then my sponsor went on an extended out-of-town trip, and he was in Jacksonville, and I was feeling lost. So I called him up one Sunday afternoon at his hotel, and he answered the phone. I talked for a little. He says, what's going on? I said, I'm feeling disconnected. And in the inimitable way that sponsors have, he says, and I'll never forget it, why did you pull the plug, stupid? And that's what I had done. I had started sitting on the laurels I hadn't earned, complaining about everybody else because I was unhappy. And I know today, as long as I stay connected in here, I don't have to do that. But I got a job offer in late 92 to go to work for a company in Jacksonville. And their headquarters were in England. So the first thing they did was they shipped me over to England for about 10 days for training. My sponsor heard about it, and he says, okay, here's what you're going to do. Not here's what I suggest you do. Here's what you're going to do. You are going to go to the central office. You are going to buy the international directory. You are going to bring it to me so that I see you've done it. And when you get there, you will call so that you can get to a meeting. And sure enough, I did all those things. I got there, and I got a call back. I left a message. I got a call back from this guy who told me he would pick me up, and he would take me to a meeting. So he meets me at the hotel. We drive over. We're in Liverpool. The only thing I can think of is this is where the Beatles started. You know, my mind is really, really on sobriety. I'm one of these really gung-ho guys. But we're sitting in this meeting, and this guy in the back of the room starts sharing. And he's got this thick Scottish brogue. But he's saying almost word for word everything my sponsor was always telling me. I turned around three times to make sure it wasn't my sponsor mimicking an accent. I mean, it's just things hit you in so many different ways. But when my sponsor heard that I was going to be going to Jacksonville frequently, he said, the next time you go to Jacksonville, you will go to this meeting at this hospital. It's at 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night. And I said, why? He said, go there and you will find out. One of the attendees at that meeting was a man by the name of Duke Patton. Duke is no longer with us, so I'm not breaking his anonymity. If you've read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, he is mentioned near the end of the book, spending time with Dr. Bob and some of the original pioneers in the Cleveland area in Akron. When I met Duke, Duke had been sober 5 years longer than I had been alive. I just could not grasp that. Just could not grasp it. But I got to talk to him one day after one of the meetings I attended with him. And Duke was in his 80s. He was losing his eyesight. He couldn't drive. He relied on people to get him to meetings. He had bad hips, so he was walking with two canes. And I was standing next to him while he was waiting for the people who brought him to the meeting to bring their car around so he could get back in the car and go home. And I asked him how he was doing. Now, I had a litany of complaints I was going to lay on this guy. And he looked at me and he said, the biggest problem I have today is the date on my birth certificate. And I'm going, well, he don't want to hear my crap. If that's his biggest problem, he don't want to hear my crap. That's, and again, I say it's one of these things where every time I go somewhere new, it seems like somebody with sobriety finds me. Now, there's got to be something written on my forehead. Help, this guy's really sick. He needs all the help he can get. I can't see it, but it happens over and over and over. And it's just amazing to me that they can identify how sick I really am and try to help me. Now, I'm a terrible introvert. I am terribly introverted. And after all these years, I still like my own company. And I know that's bad, but I do it anyway. If you see me reaching out in a meeting I haven't been to before and introducing myself, it's a major concession on my part to overcoming fear. Because I don't do that well. Now, once I get to know you, it's a different story. But I don't like being new. But a couple of years after I got the job that took me to Jacksonville, they riffed me again. And I wound up getting a job in Amarillo, Texas. Now, I don't know how many of you speak Spanish or read it. I found out just a few weeks ago that in Spanish, Amarillo means yellow. And that's a real good description of Amarillo. It's brown. It's dusty. It gets the worst weather extremes that you can think of. And that's normal for that part of the panhandle. My wife and I went up to Wisconsin for Christmas one year. We came back and found 25 inches of snow on the ground, and 3 days later we had 3 inches of rain. And that's normal. And Amarillo is so flat and it's so dry that when it rains hard like that, it floods. Because the water's got no place to go. The ground can't soak it up, and it's just, you get 12, 14 inches of water in the streets. It takes about 3-4 hours for it to drain off, and you just can't go anywhere for that period of time. Unless you like a wet car. And I've done that once, and it's just no fun. But Amarillo, I was doing a lot of traveling, and I wasn't going to many meetings, and I was complacent, but I became a very angry individual. Nothing was going the way I wanted it to go. I was making a lot of money, I had a wife who loved me, and I wasn't happy. Spent 6.5 years in Amarillo, and they were tough. They were tough. Came back here in February of 2002, finally convinced them that I could be just as useful at any place that had a good airport, and her son and her son's family were living in her old home. So we came back here, and 6 weeks after we got back, I got let go of my job. So we had no income and 3 mortgages. And one of the guys I knew from when I'd lived here before was getting ready to celebrate his 25th year. And he asked me if I'd come to this meeting that was going to pick up his 25-year chip. And it turns out that the gentleman who married us at Life College was attending that meeting. And I was talking to Chuck after the meeting, and I started going into this whole thing about, we got no income, we got three. And he says, remember what the promise says? He says, the fear of economic insecurity will leave. Don't say the economic insecurity is going to leave. Just the fear. Here we go again. I'm hearing what I need to hear, but I got to get myself into a lather to hear it. But I came back here, and again, still traveling. I got a job with a Japanese company. Now, if you've heard anything about the Japanese over the years, they do like to drink. They're not as bad as they used to be, but they do like to drink. Well, I'd go over there, and I didn't drink. They didn't know what to do with me. My coworkers loved going over to Japan with me because they got some sleep for a change. They'd drop us back at the hotel at 8 o'clock instead of 2 in the morning. So, I mean, it was an interesting experience. But if you've ever been to Japan, or if you have the opportunity, it's just a marvelous place to go. They have an interesting culture. They are just very intelligent people. They don't know how to sell, but they're very intelligent people. And as I came back just prior to my retiring, the home group I was with at the time decided they needed some people for service, and they picked on me to be the intergroup rep. And I said, okay, what does the intergroup rep do? And they gave me the information. I went to my first intergroup meeting. And this started a 6.5 year that's current thing of service that I've been going through. I thought the intergroup was fascinating until I got to be a GSR. And GSR is one of those things where they had a GSR. They needed an alternate. The GSR had a hissy fit and left the group. So I became the GSR. My first meeting in Macon, I had no idea what was going on. I didn't even know what district we were in. They had to kind of lead me by the hand. But I thought intergroup was interesting until I started going to Macon for GSR. Somebody in the district decided that I had the capability or I would be a good candidate for DCN. So I did 2 years as alternate, and for the last 6 months I've been DCN for 14C. If you get into service like this, you get a totally different perspective on what Alcoholics Anonymous is, because you realize, you start to see how the parts fit together. I thought I knew how the parts fit together. I just had a very basic idea of what it is. The information that is available to people who decide to get into that type of service is just mind-boggling. The work that goes into what gets done, the information that flows, and that's really my responsibility now, is to be an information transfer. If I hear something that should be going out to the GSRs, it's my responsibility to give it to them. And I don't take that lightly. And I don't take it lightly because I know how important it is. The more the groups know about what's going on, the better they can make decisions to assist in what's going on. I know today that sobriety is a lot more than just not taking a drink. It took me a long time to realize that. I know that I have to continue to do some type of service. I don't know, I got at least a year and a half of defined service that I'll be going through, but outside of that, I still need to be active in a group, and I need to be active with people. Because through people, I hear what I need to hear. Even with my selective hearing, I need what I need to hear. And if I'm not with you, then I don't hear it. And when I'm in my own head, I'm in a bad neighborhood. And I know it. It's one of these things where it talks a lot about prayer and meditation. And for me, if I don't pray for 1 day, God knows. If I don't pray for 2 days, I know. And if I don't pray for 3 days, everybody knows. And that's just how quick it happens. That's just how quick it happens. So it's been a real journey. It's been a privilege. I continue to be amazed that people think I can do things that I don't think I can do. But they keep telling me I need to do them. And they seem to be trying to encourage me to be better than I was the day before. And I know that that's a process that has to continue if I'm going to continue to enjoy the benefits of what I've got. And I've got a good life today. I've got a good life today. I've got 2 granddaughters who have never seen me take a drink, and they're both in their 20s. I've got a wife who loves me, and I cannot for the life of me figure out why. Why she puts up with me, I have no clue. She doesn't understand my sense of humor. I make a joke, she keeps asking me how old I am. And I heard the story years ago, but when you take your first drink, you die emotionally, and when you stop drinking, you start growing emotionally. Well, that means I'm pretty young yet. So I've got a lot of growing to do. But with people, with the support of people that I find in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can continue to do it. And it's a privilege to be able to do it, which I never thought would have been the case. I want to thank all of you for being here. I got the lucky part. You have to listen. Thank you.